Bibliophiles. This is The Book Report, and I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Sit back, take a break from all your holiday preparations, and get ready to get immersed in a winter wonderland of wonderful books. I'm here to share some new titles with you and remind you of some favorites you might have missed. We'll be speaking with two best-selling authors and introducing a new monthly feature you're going to enjoy. Trust me on that one. Also, if you're frazzled from too many forays into the mall, the show might be just the thing to spark an idea for someone on your list. So get comfy and let's get right to it.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
If you love thrillers, I bet you've read one by Brad Meltzer, The Book of Fate, The Zero Game, and The Book of Lies, which we'll be hearing a snippet from in just a moment, are just some of his bestsellers. Brad grew up in Brooklyn, New York, then moved to South Florida. He attended law school at Columbia and was selected to the prestigious Columbia Law Review. In the 90s, he got into working on comic books. In 2002, Brad created a 6-issue story arc for DC Comics' The Green Arrow. Later, he wrote 13 issues of the Justice League of America series. In 2008, Meltzer wrote an arc for Buffy the Vampire Slayer for season 8 of that comic book series. But there is so much to Brad. In 1994, he co-wrote the original swearing-in oath that is taken by all AmeriCorps members. It's been delivered by Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. In addition to his novels, he was the co-creator of the 2004 TV series Jack and Bobby. And this month, Brad will host the new History Channel series, Brad Meltzer Decoded. So look for that. In May of this year, Meltzer released his first nonfiction book, Heroes for My Son, a book he's worked on for years. The book is a collection of heroes, from Jim Henson to Rosa Parks to Mr. Rogers. It's a surprise bestseller and debuted at number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list. I spent a few moments with Brad at the Miami Book Fair, where I was amazed at the diversity of his work. Welcome, Brad. It's so great to have you here today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
How did you decide which heroes to include in your book?
That is the key question, right? I mean, this was a book called Heroes for My Son, and it's for my son, and that means you got to pick the winners. And I think it's like the Supreme Court definition of pornography, which is, you know it when you see it. And sometimes you would just see it. I remember finding out, it started with the Wright brothers. And someone told me this amazing story that every time the Wright brothers would go out to fly their plane, they would bring enough extra materials for multiple crashes. Which means every time they went out, they knew they would fail. And they would crash and rebuild and crash and rebuild, and that's why they took off. And I said, I love that story. I want my son to know that if he has perseverance and he works hard and he has a side order of stubbornness, that he could do anything in this world. And I said, that's the kind of hero I want in this book. And that's really how we picked them. We would just hear these amazing details, and one by one, we found all 50.
How were you able to kind of cull down? Because, I mean, there's such an amazing wealth of inspirational stories out there. How did you make the decision?
You know, we just, and that, you're absolutely right. It's hard to pull them down. I said I had a couple requirements. One, I knew I had to put my mother in there, right? I was not cutting her. So my mom is the most important hero in the book. When my publisher was, shutting down years ago, I was worried that my career was deteriorating in front of my eyes. And I should also tell you, my mom died 2 years ago from breast cancer. She's the reason I actually decided to finish the book. I was like, I'm not going to save the nice words for the eulogy. I'm going to do this now. So I was worried my career was over. I called my mom, terrified. And she said to me, I'd love you if you were a garbage man.
I know that Eli Segal was one of your heroes, and you actually wrote the AmeriCorps pledge. How did you meet him, and what was that story?
Yeah, Eli is one of, you know, the book is filled with people that you know. There's, you know, everyone from Jackie Robinson to Mr. Rogers to Jim Henson to Rosa Parks. But it's also filled with people nobody knows. And Eli Segal is one of those people. And when I was, and the reason he's in the book is he was my first big boy job, right? That first job out of college where someone trusts you. And he used to take me, he worked at a magazine called Games Magazine, which was, he said, he's going to pay me real money to play puzzles and games for a living. I am not that crazy. I took that job. And he said, come work at Games. It'll be fun. Don't go to law school. Stay with me. If you love it, you'll stay. And if you hate it, you leave after a year with money in your pocket. Great deal. I had all these loans to pay off. Perfect. And the week I moved my stuff to Boston, he leaves the job. So now I thought, I've wrecked my life. This is it. My life's over. So I did what all of us would do at moments where we think we've wrecked our lives. I said, I'm going to write a novel. Right? That's what we'd all do. I mean, so it seemed like a logical choice. And I started writing my first novel. My first novel got me 24 rejection letters. To be clear, there were only 20 publishers at the time. I got 24 rejection letters, which means some people are writing you twice to make sure you get the point. But I just loved it. And Eli later, 2 years later, was running AmeriCorps, the President's National Service Program. It's like a Peace Corps for the United States. And he said, you know what? I'm not going to leave you this time. Come to Washington and write for me. And he had me co-write the oath that everyone, when they get sworn into AmeriCorps, raises their hand that the President of the United States administers. And there is nothing. I've written 7 novels. I've written a nonfiction book. I've written television shows. There is nothing like watching your words come out of the President's mouth. And it was really thrilling for me. So Eli obviously made the book.
And I know that you have a background in comics as well. Can you tell us how you got into that and what are some of your big accomplishments there?
Yes, I'm just a nerd. I like history and comic books, and those are the things I love. And it's not that I love people who wear their underwear on the outside of their pants, but there is something special about Superman to me. And I think, you know, we all, when they say, oh, what are the good books you've read? Everyone likes to say, oh, it's Moby Dick. And it's, you know, you have to say something that makes you sound important and smart. But we forget the first morality tales that we ever read were comic books. That's where we really see right and wrong right at the beginning. It's part of the American mythology. And what I love about Superman is I don't love Superman. What I love and the most important part of Superman is Clark Kent. And you want to know why? Because we're all Clark Kent. We all know what it's like to be boring and ordinary and wish we could be big and strong and do something beyond ourselves to help someone. And I understand that. And that's why all the ripoffs of Superman never worked as well as Superman, because they never had Clark Kent. He was us. And that's what I love about the story. That's American mythology.
And you've written, you've contributed and written other comic books. Tell us about that.
Sure. You know, there's nothing like sitting at your computer and writing B-A-T-M-A-N, and you get to put words in Batman's mouth. That is a really fun day at work. Even your kid who's never impressed by anything goes, okay, maybe that one's cool. And so I've written Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman. I've written Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And I just love it. Again, it's part of the American mythology. The same way that Heroes for My Son is the stories of Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, I think they're as equally as important as Superman and Batman when it comes to kind of teaching right and wrong to people. And I really believe that. And I think it, again, is it's not just about being American. That's about America. We're a country founded on our legends and myths, including our own.
You know, we've been hearing a lot now about graphic novels. What is the difference for our listeners and me? What is the difference between a comic book and a graphic novel?
There is no difference. It's snobbery is the difference, right? A comic book is a graphic novel. It's just a fancy word for it so that you're not embarrassed when you're drinking white wine at your cocktail party. So feel free to say comic book. Don't be embarrassed of it. I mean, some people say, no, it has to be a full chapter book, and that's what makes a comic book different than a graphic novel. And no, it's a full novel. That's nonsense. They're comics. They're all comics. They got pictures. They got words. They're comics. I like them either way.
Well, I know that you are a Renaissance man and that you're also about to begin a TV show on the History Channel. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. In on December 2nd, Thursday night at 10 p.m., we launch Brad Meltzer's Decoded, which is, to me, the greatest title of all time. You know, I say in my house now, honey, what are we having for Brad Meltzer's dinner? Because yesterday we had Brad Meltzer's pasta, and today I'd like to have Brad Meltzer's chicken. I can't possibly take that title seriously, but Brad Meltzer's Decoded does what I do in my novels, and that is find great mysteries through history and try and solve them.
Tell us about your charitable website.
Yeah, you know, it's very simple. I believe ordinary people change the world. I don't care where you went to school. I don't care what your degrees, and I don't care how much money you make. That is all nonsense to me. I believe in regular people, and I think that's how the world gets changed. And I believe in people like Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, who were two poor kids from Cleveland, and they were the ones who gave us Superman. Two kids, 16-year-old kids, 17-year-old kids gave us Superman. That's incredible to me. So I love regular people and their ability to affect our universe. And so, you know, from the start, every book that I've ever written, when we get money from it, we donate it to charity. We don't publicize it. We don't go, you know, I mean, I said it here now, and I've really told almost nobody that, but whatever. It seems like it's you asked about it, so you get the answer. But we put this website up, Ordinary People Change the World, and we've been helping grow City Year Miami, which helps teach, again, it's like this Peace Corps for the U.S., helps, goes into the worst schools if you're 18 to 24 years old. And you get to volunteer a year for your city and work with those kids in the worst schools, volunteer in that kind of Peace Corps way. And we've been building that slowly. We have 82 kids now here in Miami, and it's all over the country. It is loved by everyone from Bush to Obama to Clinton to Nelson Mandela, you name it. It's not political. And I just think, you know, I've been lucky enough to be able to write these books and been lucky enough to find heroes and heroes for my son. And I feel like if I learned no other lesson from them, it's that you have to, of course, always give back.
How can our readers and listeners contribute or make a contribution to the website?
Yeah, you know, we take no money. I never want to touch anyone's money because I want it to always go to the charity. So 100% of what you give goes directly to the charity. If you go to ordinarypeoplechangetheworld.com, you'll see the button you can click for City Year. And you can even pick the city you want it to go to, whether you live in New York, whether you live in D.C. There's a city you're there. There's in Chicago. I mean, you name it, and they have it there. We have 21 different cities, Los Angeles. And they can just click a button. If you give $1, right, what it says right now is give $1, right? $1 to City Year, and we'll change the world. I promise you, if everyone gives $1, it will change. And that's what we're doing right now is this goal to raise money just by asking people for one single dollar.
Well, thank you so much, Brad. I'm a big fan of yours, and it's been a thrill to speak with you today.
I appreciate it, and however much they paid you to say that, I appreciate that too.
Readers, as I've mentioned, Brad has worked on comic books since the 90s. In his suspense bestseller, The Book of Lies, Meltzer mixes up two of his favorite genres. The world's most famous murder happens in Chapter 4 of the Bible. Cain kills Abel. But the Bible is silent about one key detail, the weapon Cain used to kill his brother. That weapon was lost to history. In 1932, Mitchell Siegel was killed by 3 gunshots to the chest. While mourning, his son dreamed up a bulletproof man and created the world's greatest hero, Superman. And, like Cain's murder weapon, the gun used in this unsolved murder has never been found. Until now. Fast forward to the present day. Cal Harper comes face to face with his family's greatest secret, his long-lost father, a man who had been shot with a gun that could be traced back to Mitchell Siegel's 1932 murder. But before Cal can ask a single question, he and his father are attacked by a ruthless killer tattooed with the ancient markings of Cain. So begins the chase for the world's first murder weapon. What does Cain, history's greatest villain, have to do with Superman, the world's greatest hero? And what do the two murders, committed thousands of years apart, have in common? This is the mystery at the heart of Brad Meltzer's riveting and utterly intriguing thriller, The Book of Lies. It's read by Scott Brick. Let's listen.
The blow hit her like a baseball bat, sending her stumbling backward. Mom, look out for... Her heel hit the mayonnaise at full speed, and she flipped backward like a seesaw. If Lloyd hadn't been so big or so enraged, if he hadn't blown up with such a fierce physical outburst, He might not have shoved her so hard, but he did. And as she fell backward, still looking at Calvin, she had no idea that the back of her neck was headed straight toward the lower kitchen drawer that was still wide open. Calvin tried to run forward, but could scarcely lift his arms and legs. In midair, his mother was turned toward him, her alligator eyes still burning through him. There was no mistaking her final thought. She wasn't scared, or even in pain. She was angry at him, the white, blonde, wet-haired boy who caused her to drop the mayo, and from that day forward, in his 9-year-old mind, the person who caused her to fall. Mom! She was falling. Then the sound was unforgettable. Rosie! His father screamed, leaping forward and scooping her head toward his chest, her arms ragdolled across the mayonnaise-smeared floor. Calvin, don't you look, Lloyd cried. The tears were running down his twisted Irish nose. Close your eyes. Don't you look. But Calvin looked. He wanted to cry, but nothing came. He wanted to run, but couldn't move. As he stood frozen, a stream of urine ran down his right leg. Most lives crumble over time. Cal Harper's crumbled in one crashing fall. But 19 years later, thanks to a single call on his radio, he'd begin his quest through history and finally have a chance to put his life together. Chapter 1. 19 years later, Hong Kong. Good girl. Such a good girl, Ellis said, down on one knee as his dog snatched the beef treat from his open palm. With a bite and a gulp, the treat was gone, and Ellis Belasco, with his sleek copper-red hair, smiled proudly and added a strong, authoritative pat to the back of his smoky brown pet's neck. As the trainer said, attack dogs had to be rewarded. Please, my leg... He chewed my leg, the thin Chinese man whined as he crawled across the worn beige carpet toward the hotel room door. To be clear, he chewed your Achilles tendon, Ellis said, calmly standing up and brushing back his long European-style haircut. He was always meticulous, to reveal amber eyes framed by striking lush eyebrows that almost merged on the bridge of his nose. Because of his rosy coloring, his cheeks were always flushed, as were his full lips, which he licked as he stared down at a small tattoo between his thumb and pointer finger. A man and dog surrounded by a crescent moon and 2 stars. His birthright was healing nicely. For the past 2 months, Ellis had been tracking the ancient book from collector to collector, from the doctor in China whose death gave it away, to Zhao, the shipper, who schemed to deliver it elsewhere. Every culture called it by a different name, but Ellis knew the truth. I know you have it, Ellis said. I'd like the Book of Lies now. From the corner of the bed, Ellis reached for his small gray pistol. No. You can't. My fiancée. We just got engaged, the young dock worker begged, scrambling on his one good knee as his other leg left a smear of blood across the carpet. Ellis pressed the barrel of his gun against the man's throat. It was vital he hit the jugular, but he knew he would. That was the advantage of having God on your side. I paid what you asked me, Zhao, Ellis said calmly. But it makes me sad that someone else clearly paid you more. I swear, the book. I told you where it's going, Zhao screamed.
Higgins Clark is an actress and the author of 9 best-selling Reagan Riley mysteries. Born in New York, Carol attended Mount Holyoke College. It was during this time she began retyping manuscripts for her very famous mother, Mary Higgins Clark. She also started making contributions to her mother's books, such as renaming locations and characters. As a natural evolution, she and her mother have since collaborated on a best-selling holiday mystery series. I'll play you a preview from that entertaining series a little later on the show. You are probably familiar with the great scope of work by Mary Higgins Clark. One main difference in the writing of the two Higgins Clarks is that Carol's books contain humor, while her mother's classic books stick to suspense. So readers, if you're looking for a great title for someone on your list who likes their mysteries mixed up with fun, pick up one. I had the pleasure of speaking with the very charming Carol at the recent Miami Book Fair.
Welcome, Carol. It's so great to have you here today.
Thank you, Elaine. It's great to be with you.
Well, your book, Wrecked, is another Reagan Riley mystery, and it's fabulous. Set on the Cape, do you vacation on the Cape yourself?
Well, my mother bought a house there about 30 years ago, and we had started going there when I was about 11, just renting places, and so I thought I should finally set a book at Cape Cod, because I've been there enough, certainly.
Okay, personal question. What's your favorite ice cream store on the Cape?
Oh, what's it called? The Smuggler? Is that it? It's in Dennis. My nieces and nephews are always running out to it. I think it's The Smuggler, and they bring back great ice cream.
All right, so how do you learn to write? How do you learn how to write so that you keep readers on the edge of their seats?
Gosh, that's quite a question. I started by retyping my mother's books, which helped me a lot. I learned so much from that. And then now when I'm writing, if I can just keep myself interested, you know, you want to keep the story going and create characters people care about or don't like or form some feeling about. And you just go with it, and hopefully you're telling a good story.
And you do tell a great story. Now, what do you have to say about readers who can't stand the suspense and skip to the end of the book to find out what happens?
Well, I don't know how, because so many things happen along the way that plot lines are introduced. Everything doesn't come out in the first chapter of what's going to happen. So I laugh when they do that, but I think that they miss out on certain things that go on in the book that, I mean, if you read the last chapter and had only read the first, I don't think you'd even get a lot of what's going on in the last chapter.
Do you get spooked by other suspense writers' writings? And if so, who?
Oh, well, my mother, of course. I mean, I have to say my mother. She always said that one time when she was writing, when she was home alone, she went and got the dog and brought him downstairs to sit with her at her feet because she was really getting scared just by what she was writing. My books are more humorous, so I don't really scare people as much, but I enjoy being scared.
How do you make your characters real people?
I think, well, sometimes you might base a character a little bit on someone you know. You never really create an entire character because you could get in trouble. But I think you just try and really, I observe people. I had started as an actor. I took acting class. So you try and learn about what makes people tick, and just human beings in general are interesting. So I just try and create characters that a lot of my characters are a little eccentric or funny or different, but you just want to make them flesh and blood.
So you use real people's quirks and nuances in your characters?
Sometimes, but I create characters just from my head as well. It's that's the challenge. You say, did I have a character like this in the last book or in two books ago? You don't want to repeat yourself, and so you just work at it, really.
In this book, you have some small business owners, Pillow Talk. Now, how would they react to the Pay Fairness Act that recently failed to pass in the Senate? I mean, are they political at all?
I don't really get into that in books because mine are just meant to be lighthearted, so I don't try and get into too much controversy. Again, because that's just not the style of my books. Mine are meant to just make you laugh, hopefully, and entertain you, so I kind of avoid the whole political scene.
What project are you working on currently?
It's called Mobbed, and this time it's set at the Jersey Shore, which people have heard about lately. My mother has a house in Spring Lake, and I had gone to the Jersey Shore when I was younger. So I thought it would be fun to set a book there because Reagan's, my character, grew up in New Jersey, and her parents have a place there. So her mother and she are going to a celebrity auction. A woman had rented her house to an actress who disappeared, and now it's a year later, so she's selling things, and no one knows what happened to the actress, and naturally, you know, different things go on. So that's what I'm working on now, which will I'll finish up, and it'll be out in April.
I think so many of your books and Wrecked would make a great movie. Are there any plans for that?
Well, that's what we're hoping. I've had some interest. It just hasn't happened yet. And so we're going to try and get a good screenplay written of Deck the Halls, which was the first Christmas book my mother and I wrote together. And my sister-in-law is actually taking a screenwriting class because we'd like to all do it together, and she's getting the nuts and bolts of it. But I'd love to see Reagan in a series. I think it would be fun, but it's finding the right producer.
Yeah, I think so, too. Now, what mystery suspense authors do you read in your spare time, or do you go to a totally different genre for your relaxation?
Oh, I read all kinds, but I'm in a writer's group the first Tuesday of every month. Susan Isaacs, Linda Fairstein, Harlan Coben, they're all in it. I love to read their works. And then whatever I hear about, you know, who has a new book out lately, you always want to see what someone else is doing and hopefully learn from them as well.
Okay, thank you so much. Readers, Wrecked by Carol Higgins Clark. You're really going to want to pick this one up. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Elaine.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really? And how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Carol's latest novel, Wrecked, opens as our heroine, private investigator Reagan Riley, and her husband, Jack, head of the NYPD Major Case Squad, are about to celebrate their first wedding anniversary with a quiet weekend on Cape Cod. Arriving at their holiday destination late at night, Reagan and Jack settle in just as a major storm begins to blow. The next morning, Cape Cod is quite a sight, churning whitecaps on the bay, winds howling, and sheets of rain pouring from the sky. Reagan is looking forward to a cozy day with Jack. But their plans are washed away as a body is discovered on the beach at the house just next door. Readers, get ready to investigate another case with Reagan Riley. Here is Wrecked by Carol Higgins Clark, read by Michelle Pock.
Jack was 6'2", with hazel eyes and sandy hair. He was wearing jeans and a windbreaker. Put milk on your list. I thought Skip brought in milk for us. He did. Only trouble is, he managed to produce a container that expired 2 weeks ago. Jack laughed. That kid is unbelievable. I don't know why my mother doesn't fire him. That'll never happen, Reagan said. His little boy lost quality has made your mother feel very maternal and protective of him. Jack shook his head, leaned down to give Reagan a kiss, and put his arms around her. I'll pick up some muffins. I'm not trusting that anything he bought for us is edible. He hugged Reagan tight. It's so great to be here alone with you. No work to distract us. Jack was head of the NYPD Major Case Squad. Reagan was a private investigator. They had both been busy with cases that thankfully wrapped up in the past few days. "It is going to be a wonderful weekend," Reagan said as Jack released her. "I'll jump in the shower and look forward to your return." Jack laughed. "What you really want is for me to hurry back with the milk so you can have your first cup of coffee." "You know me so well," Reagan murmured as Jack headed for the front door. In the downstairs master bathroom, Reagan turned on the shower. The hot water felt so good on her shoulders and back. A few minutes later, she pulled a pair of jeans and a sweater out of her suitcase on the bedroom floor. "I don't think I've ever been alone in this house," she thought. "So why don't I feel alone?" She dressed, brushed her dark hair, then started to apply makeup to her pale skin. With her blue eyes, she fell into the category of Black Irish. "It might not be sunny outside, but I need more light," Reagan thought. She stepped over to the window, fumbled for the cord, then gave it a yank. The curtains flew open. A man in a yellow hooded slicker had his nose pressed against the glass. Reagan screamed. It was Skip. He stumbled back. "Sorry," he yelled. Reagan couldn't hear the rest of what he was saying. She turned the handle of the window, which opened out. "Sorry," Skip yelled again through the roaring wind. "I was just checking the drain pipes." "I'll bet," Reagan thought. "You startled me," she said, her heart beating wildly. "I didn't mean to. This storm caused a lot of damage on the Cape. I'd like to come in and check all the windows and the basement, make sure there are no leaks or anything." He smiled up at Reagan. Curls of brown hair escaped from the hood of his rain gear. His face was the picture of innocence, but Reagan felt unnerved. "Okay," she said, wanting to ask him how he managed to buy expired milk. "I'll check the other drain pipes, then come on in," Skip said, waving his hands. "You can't be too careful, you know." "No, you can't," Reagan agreed as she cranked the window shut. Jack's mother had joked that the minute Skip came into the house, he never stopped talking. Months of living alone up here in the wintertime took its toll. When he finally got an audience, he never let them go. Well, Reagan thought, her heart still racing, "I'm sure Jack can handle it. I wish he was here right now." The sound of the front door opening flooded her with relief. "Reagan?" Jack called. "Thank God," Reagan thought as she raced out of the bedroom and down the hall. "Jack, I'm so glad you're back." When she got to the living room, she stopped short. The two gossipy women who lived in the house three doors down were standing with Jack. Reagan couldn't think of their names, but knew that they were sisters. They were like a double dose of Mrs. Kravitz, the quintessential nosy neighbor on the old TV series Bewitched. "Gee, you two are like newlyweds," one of them cackled. "Look at the way you run and greet your husband when he only was gone a few minutes buying the newspaper." "Jack tells us it's your first anniversary," the other chimed in. "The way you act, it seems more like you got married yesterday." Reagan managed a smile. "I was just worried with him being out in this storm. I understand it's done quite a bit of damage." "Oh, you're right about that, Reagan," the taller sister said.
As promised, here is a holiday treat from the beloved mother-daughter duo, Mary Higgins Clark and Carol Higgins Clark. Dashing Through the Snow begins in a picturesque New Hampshire village where the townsfolk are preparing for the first annual Festival of Joy. The night before the festival begins, a group of employees at the local market learn they've won $160 million in the lottery. But then, one of the employees goes missing, and the town goes topsy-turvy. The Clark's endearing heroes, Elvira Meehan, amateur sleuth, and private investigator Reagan Riley, happen to be in town for the festival.
One thing leads to another, and as this dynamic duo begins to investigate, they find that life in this quaint little town is not as idyllic as it's been painted. So much for an old-fashioned weekend in the country. Let's listen to Dashing Through the Snow by Mary Higgins Clark and Carol Higgins Clark, read by Carol herself.
By the end of the meeting, the enthusiasm had spread to a fever pitch. Now, 3 months later, the festival would begin the next day. The opening ceremony was scheduled for Friday at 5 p.m. in the town square. Branscombe's huge Christmas tree had already been lit. All the other trees along Main Street and around the Bowling Green would go on at exactly the same moment as Santa arrived on his horse-drawn sleigh. Candles would be distributed, and the church choir would lead the crowd in singing Christmas carols. A buffet supper in the church basement would be followed by the first of many screenings of It's a Wonderful Life. On Saturday, Nora Reagan Riley, whose son-in-law was a close college friend of the mayor, would be signing her just-published book during the holiday bazaar. She had also agreed to hold a story hour with the children. Outside, there would be hay rides and sleigh rides, and ice skaters would be serenaded by recordings of Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra singing everyone's favorite Christmas music. Saturday night, another buffet supper would be followed by a staging of a Christmas carol, performed by the amateur Branscombe Thespian Group. Sunday morning, the festivities would wrap up with a pancake breakfast, yet another meal to be held in the church basement. So far, all the plans were running smoothly. Over at Conklin's Market, the employees were working nonstop to prepare for the festival. The festival had been a great idea for the town and for Conklin's business, but the workers were worn out. The holiday season, from Thanksgiving through New Year's Day, was always busy. But this year, things were crazed. And thanks to the television coverage, more and more people from the surrounding towns were expected to join in the activities. The workers at Conklin's had to be ready to supply extra food at a moment's notice. They knew they wouldn't be able to enjoy a single minute of the festivities themselves, but they were sure that Mr. Conklin would reward them with a bigger bonus than usual, a bonus that traditionally had been handed out by now. Some of the staff had even been grumbling that they hadn't received it yet. Tonight, the 8 o'clock closing hour couldn't come fast enough for any of them. At 10 of 8, Glenda, the head cashier, was locking up one of the registers when the front door flew open and Mr. Conklin's bossy new wife, Rhoda, marched in, followed by her increasingly sheepish husband, Sam, whom she now referred to as Samuel. In her late 50s, Rhoda and old man Conklin had met at a senior singles dance in Boston when he was visiting his son for the weekend. It didn't take Rhoda long to realize that Sam was ripe for the picking. A recent widower, he didn't know what hit him until one day he found himself in his best blue suit, a flower in his lapel, and the sight of Rhoda in a glittery cocktail dress marching down the aisle toward him. Since then, life at Conklin's had not been the same. Rhoda was trying to put her stamp on a 40-year-old business that had run just fine without her. She told Ralph the butcher, whose roasted turkeys were legendary, that he was using too much butter when he basted them. Her attempt to convince the sweet-faced 75-year-old Marion, who had run the bakery department since day one, to use canned fillers for her cakes and pies was not well received. Tommy, a burly, ruggedly handsome young man in his 20s, who had a magical way with salads and sandwiches, was told to cut down on the generous portions of cold cuts he allotted to the submarine sandwiches. Duncan, the head of produce, was mortally offended when Rhoda retrieved a bruised apple he'd tossed out and put it back in the bin. And then there was Glenda. Glenda knew, because she handled the cold, hard cash, that whenever Rhoda was around, she was being watched like a hawk.
I know it's the holiday season, and visions of sugar plums should be dancing in all of our heads, blah, blah, blah. But admit it, sometimes we need an escape from it all. So ladies and gentlemen, scalpels up, and let's get to the heart of some fast-paced suspense. There's a brand new Kay Scarpetta tale from Patricia Cornwall, Port Mortuary. And in it, we travel back to the beginning of Kay's professional career, where she enlisted in the Air Force to pay off her medical school debt. And she wound up as a coroner. Now, more than 20 years and many successes later, secret military ties have drawn her to the Dover Air Force Base, where she's been immersed in a training fellowship to master the art of CT-assisted virtual autopsy, a procedure the White House has mandated she introduce to the private sector. As the chief of a new forensic center in Massachusetts, Scarpetta is confronted with a case that could shut down her new facility and ruin her personally and professionally. A young man dies, apparently from cardiac arrhythmia, but when his body is examined the next morning, there are stunning indications that he may have been alive when he was zipped into the pouch and locked inside the center's cooler. 3D radiology scans reveal more shocking details about internal injuries unlike any Scarpetta has ever seen. Kay realizes she is fighting a cunning and cruel enemy, and she must race against time to discover who is behind the murder and why. In Port Mortuary, Patricia Cornwall reunites Scarpetta with Marino, Benton, and Lucy in an intimate way reminiscent of the early novels. Let's listen to Kate Redding's narration.
The wall clock above the shiny white sinks reads 1633 hours, lit up red like a warning. In less than 90 minutes, I'm supposed to appear on CNN and explain what a forensic radiologic pathologist, or RADPATH, is, and why I've become one, and what Dover and the Department of Defense and the White House have to do with it. In other words, I'm not just a medical examiner anymore, I suppose I'll say, and not just a habeas reservist with the AFME, either. Since 9/11, since the United States invaded Iraq, and now the surge of troops in Afghanistan, I rehearse points I should make, the line between the military and civilian worlds has forever faded. An example I might give. This past November, during a 48-hour period, 13 fallen warriors were flown here from the Middle East, and just as many casualties arrived from Fort Hood, Texas. Mass casualty isn't restricted to the battlefield, although I'm no longer sure what constitutes a battlefield. Maybe every place is one, I will say on TV. Our homes, our schools, our churches, commercial aircraft, and where we work, shop, and go on vacation. I sort through toiletries as I sort through comments I need to make about 3D imaging radiology, the use of computerized tomography or CT scans in the morgue. And I remind myself to emphasize that although my new headquarters in Cambridge, Massachusetts, is the first civilian facility in the United States to do virtual autopsies, Baltimore will be next, and eventually the trend will spread. The traditional post-mortem examination of dissect as you go and take photographs after the fact and hope you don't miss something or introduce an artifact can be dramatically improved by technology and made more precise. And it should be. I'm sorry I'm not doing world news tonight, because now that I think of it, I'd rather have this dialogue with Diane Sawyer. The problem with my being a regular on CNN is that familiarity often breeds contempt, and I should have thought about this before now. The interview could get personal, it occurs to me, and I should have mentioned the possibility to General Briggs. I should have told him what happened this morning when the irate mother of a dead soldier ripped into me over the phone, accusing me of hate crimes and threatening to take her complaints to the media. Metal bangs like a gunshot as I shut my locker door. I pad over tan tile that always feels cool and smooth beneath my bare feet, carrying my plastic basket of olive oil shampoo and conditioner, an exfoliant scrub made of fossilized marine algae, a a safety razor, a can of shaving gel for sensitive skin, liquid detergent, a washcloth, mouthwash, a toothbrush, a nail brush, and fragrant Neutrogena oil I'll use when I'm done. Inside an open stall, I neatly arrange my personal effects on the tile ledge and turn on the water as hot as I can stand it, hard spray blasting as I move around to get all of me, then lifting my face up, then looking down at the floor, at my own pale feet. I let water pound the back of my neck and head in hopes that stiff muscles will relax a little as I mentally enter the closet inside my base lodging and explore what to wear. General Briggs, John as I refer to him when we're alone, wants me in an airman battle uniform, or better yet, Air Force blues, and I disagree. I should wear civilian clothes, what people see me in most of the time when I do television interviews, probably a simple dark suit, an ivory blouse with a collar, and the understated Breguet watch on a leather strap that my niece Lucy gave me. Not the Blancpain with its oversized black face and ceramic bezel, which also is from her, because she's obsessed with timepieces, with anything technically complicated and expensive. Not pants, but a skirt and heels, so I come across as non-threatening and accessible, a trick I learned long ago in court. For some reason, jurors like to see my legs while I describe in graphic anatomical detail fatal wounds and the agonal last moments of a victim's life. Briggs will be displeased with my choice in attire, but I reminded him during the Super Bowl last night when we were having drinks that a man shouldn't tell a woman what to wear unless he's Ralph Lauren.
Introducing a new monthly feature of the Book Report to help you select the next books on your list. We're going to be speaking to Anne Bartholomew, senior editor at Amazon.com. She'll announce their best books list for the month of December. I know I've always wondered how titles make it to that lofty list. Best Books of the Month promotes an authoritative selection of new releases across fiction, nonfiction, children's, and teens books, giving readers an opportunity to discover the most anticipated, buzzed about, and unique books available. Amazon editors survey a wide selection of new releases to determine which books are truly best. The result is a list that's fresh, riveting, and highly recommendable. Welcome, Anne. So nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Elaine. Good to be here.
Can you begin with telling us a little about the process of how your colleagues decide what books make it to the list?
Sure. We're always looking at, you know, what's coming out. We have a very dedicated team of editors who are scouting for new releases all the time. So we convene every month to kind of collect together all the books that we found that we've been reading and looking at for Best of the Month, and we talk about, you know, kind of what's generally on the horizon for a given month and make recommendations to each other about about what we think are the best books to recommend every month. So we do a lot of kind of collective discussion, and to decide we bring kind of our all-in pick to the table, and we talk to the team about why we love it, why we think it's a great book to recommend, talk about the author. We try to get other people on the team to read it to kind of build consensus, and then we typically take a vote after that to decide which book is going to be our spotlight pick and what other books will make it in the list. Mm-hmm. So we have 10 books every month that we promote, usually 7 books on the adult side, and then we pick 3 books for kids and young readers for different age groups.
Mm-hmm. How many of your colleagues are on the panel?
So it's about 5 to 7 every month that are actively reading and reviewing.
Does each editor have an area of expertise?
We all read, pretty voraciously and across different categories, and that's one of our, you know, tenets of the program is to look at everything that's coming out and really decide what are the best books, and not necessarily the best fiction or the best memoir, but what do we think people should be reading right now.
What happens when there's some really heated discussions among your panel and lots of disagreements?
You know, those are the typically the best meetings, because I think that they're so true of what real, you know, what our customers and readers really do when they, you know, meet and talk about books. I mean, I think we've had some picks that have been really for and against, like this year, particularly Emma Donoghue's Room, which is a book that we picked for September, was one that a lot of editors on the team really loved, but others were really just couldn't get into it.
I actually loved that book, and I previewed it on an earlier show. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you share some of the top titles on December's list?
Absolutely. December, actually, I think, is a really great month, and typically December is hard for us because it's not a big month for new releases in the industry. I think it's just people are really focused on, you know, sort of end of the year and holiday, so it's not always has the best selection for things that are new, but I think that we have a really interesting and kind of eclectic mix this month. Our spotlight title is Long Last Happy, new and collected stories by Barry Hanna. We also have a debut mystery called The Sherlockian by Graham Moore. Totally fun, rollicking read. I think for Sherlock Holmes fans, they'll appreciate all the kind of inside references to him and to his books. I think comes along in a tradition of other books that have kind of looked at sort of literary heroes.
Well, where and when can our listeners find this list?
It's on Amazon.com, and you can find it from our homepage.
When in the month does it get listed? On day one, or?
Yes, day one.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, Anne.
You're welcome.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Any dog lovers on your list? You, perhaps? Then grab the tissues. This heartwarming novel told from a dog's perspective is warm and waggly tail wonderful. A Dog's Purpose, a novel for humans by W. Bruce Cameron, begins with the story of a mutt named Toby. After a short existence, the pooch is reincarnated into a golden retriever named Bailey. He finds a loving home with 8-year-old Ethan. Bailey loves Ethan without bounds, as only a dog can. He believes this must be his purpose. This must be why he was reborn. But after a long life with the boy, Bailey dies yet again and is reborn as a German Shepherd police dog. As Bailey ponders his new existence and what his new purpose must be, the bond he had with Ethan never wavers. How could I possibly have a more important mission than loving the boy, he wonders. Yet he begins the journey of life again, searching for its meaning. Listeners, I think you'll be convinced that if dogs could talk, they would sound exactly like this. Bailey's observations on human life are naive, yet clever, and often hysterically funny. He is the Forrest Gump of the canine set. For fans of Marley and Me and The Art of Racing in the Rain, this will be your new favorite dog book. It teaches us that love never dies, that our true friends are always with us, and that every creature on earth is born with a purpose. I think that's a great message for holiday time. Let's listen to George K. Wilson's reading of A Dog's Purpose.
So as soon as Mother left the nest, we did it again. This time Hungry joined us, though once he was in the culvert, he sprawled in the cool mud and fell asleep. Exploring seemed like the right thing to do. We needed to find other things to eat. Mother, getting impatient with us, was standing up when we weren't even finished feeding, which I could only blame on the other dogs. If Hungry weren't so relentless, if Fast weren't so bossy, if Sister didn't wiggle so much, I knew Mother would hold still and allow us to fill our bellies. Couldn't I always coax her to lie down, usually with a sigh, when I reached up for her while she stood above us? Often Mother would spend extra time licking Hungry, while I seethed at the injustice. By this time, Fast and Sister had grown larger than I. My body was the same size, but my legs were shorter and stubbier. Hungry was the runt of the litter, of course, and it bothered me that Fast and Sister always abandoned me to play with each other, as if Hungry and I belonged together out of some sort of natural order in the pack. Since Fast and Sister were more interested in each other than the rest of the family, I punished them by depriving them of my company, going off by myself deep into the culvert. I was sniffing at something deliciously dead and rotten one day, when right in front of me, a tiny animal exploded into the air. A frog! Delighted, I leaped forward, attempting to pounce on it with my paws, but the frog jumped again. It was afraid, although all I wanted to do was play, and probably wouldn't eat it. Fast and Sister sensed my excitement and came stampeding into the culvert, knocking me over as they skidded to a stop in the slimy water. The frog hopped and Fast lunged at it, using my head as a springboard. I snarled at him, but he ignored me. Sister and Fast fell all over themselves to get at the frog, who managed to land in a pool of water and kick away in silent, rapid strokes. Sister put her muzzle in the pond and snorted, sneezing water over Fast and me. Fast climbed on her back, the frog, my frog, forgotten. Sadly, I turned away. It looked as though I lived in a family of dimwits. I was to think of that frog often in the days that followed, usually just as I drifted off to sleep. I found myself wondering how it would have tasted. More and more frequently, Mother would growl softly when we approached, and the day she clicked her teeth together in warning when we came at her in a greedy tumble, I despaired that my siblings had ruined everything. Then Fast crawled to her, his belly low, and she lowered her snout to him. He licked her mouth, and she rewarded him by bringing up food, and we rushed forward to share. Fast pushed us away, but we knew the trick now, and when I sniffed and licked my mother's jaws, she gave me a meal. At this point, we had all become thoroughly familiar with the creek bed, and had tracked up and down it until the whole area was redolent with our odors. Fast and I spent most of our time dedicated to the serious business of play, and I was beginning to understand how important it was to him for the game to wind up with me on my back, his mouth chewing my face and throat. Sister never challenged him, but I still wasn't sure I liked what everyone seemed to assume was the natural order of our pack. Hungry, of course, didn't care about his status, so when I was frustrated, I bit his ears. One afternoon, I was drowsily watching Sister and Fast yank on a scrap of cloth they'd found, when my ears perked up. An animal of some kind was coming, something large and loud. I scrambled to my feet, but before I could race down the creek bed to investigate the noise, Mother was there, her body rigid with warning. I saw with surprise that she had Hungry in her teeth, carrying him in a fashion that we'd left behind weeks ago. She led us into the dark culvert and crouched down, her ears flat against her head. The message was clear, and we heeded it.
Our time is up.
I've so enjoyed our books and our guests today. Take good care during these crazy busy days, and remember to take time to enjoy a good book. Thanks again to Aaron James for our theme music, which you could order for any blues lovers on your list. Check out all her music at aaronjames.com.
I'm Eileen Charles, and I'll see you next time on The Book Report.
Now it's much too late.